Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We have tried to move beyond sports. We talked so much politics, and former governor and presidential candidate Martin O'Malley joined us last week. This week, Ben Cardin, John Sarbanes, Paul too, if we could invite him on. And we are expecting later on in the month to grab Governor Larry Hogan. But as much as they try to pull me out of the sports world, sports pulls me back in because – great people are writing some books as well as a rock and roll. We're going to have Rob Halford from Judas Priest on in a couple weeks. But when they told me that Paul Westhead had a book and he was doing the media junket tour, I said, man, I want to have the coach on. I had him on many, many, many moons ago. Back during the – we're talking women's college basketball and women's pro basketball. I remember having a conversation on my radio show, my nationally syndicated program, probably 20 years ago. It is a pleasure to have Paul Westhead back on my program. He probably doesn't remember, but I remember all the big names. And, you know, I think back to the Lakers and Showtime and all of that. But I've always wanted to have you on to talk about Philadelphia and St. Joe's and the Palestra. So it is a pleasure to have you on, and I know you have some Baltimore roots too. You do a poor Philadelphia man's Baltimore accent from what I heard there, Coach.
Well, Nestor, when I was a small boy, my parents and my family lived in Baltimore. We lived just outside of Bowie, and
we call that Washington here now.
I pride myself in not saying Baltimore. I say Baltimore.
That just means you've been here. That means you've been here. You know, right. I look back at the pictures of, like, Jabbar in a Bucks jersey with Unsell when West died earlier this year. And, you know, see the Baltimore Civic Center, now the Royal Farms Arena, one of our great sponsors. And, you know, the Baltimore Bullets. When I say Baltimore Bullets to a guy like you, what does that mean to you, Paul Westhead?
Well, you know, I coached in the NBA – enough to coach against them. I remember the great Wes Unseld, and Unseld will always be etched in my brain. He's the one who got a defensive rebound. He demonstrated this to a defensive rebound, turned and in the air threw the ball and hit the opposite backboard. So if you ever wondered about Wes Unseld's strength and power, there was none better than him.
Could have been a quarterback.
He could have been.
You know, you've written a book, and, you know, I'm going to pull it up for everybody, and I would have thought you'd written 10 books by now, right? I mean, certainly you had a theory, you had a style, you had something you were known for better or worse. You had a system, you know, literally. You've lived a hell of a life in basketball to make it this far. You know, at this point, to see a plague and see them play the NBA through a plague and see LeBron James and see the evolution of the game, you know, and not just that, how many people you've met, different spaces in the women's game. I mean, literally, you've lived quite a life. I mean, I'm really looking forward to taking a look at this book, Coach.
Well, thanks, Nestor. It's been a nice journey. Much of the book is about my 20 jobs that I had coaching, and it's not as praiseworthy as you would think since I'm the author, but I got fired in 14 of them. So there were a lot of downtimes where the team would say, there's a train leaving tomorrow, be under it. So and it lets me enjoy the good times when we're able to win and win some championships.
Is that something even in the modern era people don't understand about winning and losing and sports and sort of the dehumanizing of it? And certainly as the money has grown, you know, I mean, obviously if you'd spent 10 years in the NBA now, you'd have a different lifestyle than maybe 30 or 40 years ago for anyone, right, in any modern sport. But the part where you've been fired 14 times, that – most people haven't been fired once or twice in their life, and if they did, it's the darkest day of their life, other than a death or, you know, some other tragedy that happens to you. But there is some sense of resilience, right, that happens for everyone in any sort of supervisory role in sports, right?
Well, there's no question, although I have great empathy for people who get fired for the first time, because when it happened to me, I was coaching the Lakers. We had won a championship, and a year and a half later, I'm fired, and I go home, and I feel like I'm old Yeller, like somehow I did something wrong. But after the years go by and you get fired over and again, you realize it's not personal. It's a business.
It's not you, it's them.
And all you hope for is that you're able to get another job. That's the key to the coaching market. If you, no matter what happened to you in your past job, can you get the next job? And I was pretty successful in doing that part.
I'm going to ask you a really weird question. When did you really understand basketball? I mean, when did it come to you that, like, you know, one day I'll be a coach, I'll be a college coach? Or, I mean, I would think for most people who play, and I've talked to so many coaches who didn't make it or were only marginal to some degree. I mean, like John Harbaugh locally here is a guy who played at college, you know, played a good college level. His brother was otherworldly, you know, at playing. Right. And now he's been this student of the game that when you're not big enough, strong enough, good, you find other ways to be productive. And I did the last ever interview with Earl Weaver in his life and talked to him about why he became a manager. And quite frankly, he failed as a player. You know, the first thing you say is, well, it's the next thing you do when you're old enough or whatever. But then there's really understanding it well enough to be really good at teaching it. You know, I've read a lot of wooden books, right? And and I love all of that sort of theory about how this happens and how you get a team to come together.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a process, Nestor. You know, I played at St. Joseph's College in Philadelphia under Jack Ramsey. So I was steeped in, you know, basketball, Big Five basketball. And so I had a love of the game. But I wouldn't say I was sitting on the bench, you know, saying I'm going to be a coach someday, so I better study what's going on. It's kind of funny. Years later, I reflected, people said, well, what kind of coach was Jack Ramsey? I said, he was a great coach. He said, what kind of play offense did he have? And I said, I don't remember any plays. I didn't know we had plays. So it just
– So you didn't know basketball then, even though you were out and the coach trusted that you knew what the hell was going on.
Yeah, but I realized that the players that you have in front of you, if you think that they go home and X and O and study the plays like you do, you're mistaken. They barely know the plays because they're just going to do their thing. But that helped me. Ramsey got me my first job. I was an assistant at the University of Dayton because I had a teaching position out there. I was a classroom teacher, a professor of English. And so once you get started and it kind of gets in your blood, then I fell in love with coaching basketball.
Oh, professor of English writing a book. How about that all these years, huh?
Yeah, well, and my thesis at Villanova University was on Titus Andronicus, which is the little known play of William Shakespeare. So my thesis is in the library. I'm sure no one has ever looked at it. So
put it up on the internet. Let us all read it, Coach.
So I could say anything, and no one has ever read Titus Andronicus, so I become the resident expert.
Paul Westhead is here. He has a new book out right now, and we're going to be talking about that and the life and times and St. Joe's. So one of my dear friends is Dick Girardi, longtime Philadelphia Daily News, a Baltimorean as well, and I have him on all the time. And he and I have a running gig. We've been to, I don't know, 35 or 40 Preaknesses together because he covers horse racing and he covers basketball in the Big Five. He's now doing the Penn State color, but we're lifer friends. And I have never been to the Palestra, Coach. So I was up in Philly a couple of weeks ago. I mean, so million games, million concerts at the Spectrum, all of that. Dr. J at the Spectrum. I saw the Lakers and Iverson play a final year. But I've never been to the Palestra. I know it's hallowed ground. Girardi and I are talking about eating cheesesteaks and pretzels, you know, up there and whatnot. Tell me about the Palestra because I got to get up there someday.
Well, the Palestra, when you walk in, you're not impressed. It's like an old, beat-up gymnasium. I think it's the...
That's what's impressive.
Yeah, it's the second oldest, court in America. But when it fills up and it's not a maximum, it's probably around 9,000-plus that they can squeeze in there. There's just an excitement that's going on, and it's the competition. It's the Villanova versus LaSalle, St. Joe's versus Temple. And of course it's the home of the University of Pennsylvania. So they always bring a big crowd. So the excitement is what makes the palestra, and the players know it, and therefore they play extra hard when they're in the palestra.
Man, Philadelphian basketball all these years later, we're right down the road here. What an incredible sort of tradition, though, right? Like, I would think when you think of Baltimore, you think of all the Bob Wade and the Dunbar and the Muggsies and all the players that have been through here. Then you think about Philadelphia basketball and, I mean, all, through Kobe, obviously, and the tragedy this year. But Philly and basketball, I mean, I remember having long conversations with Jimmy Lynam when he was coaching the Bullets and I was on the beat 25 years ago, and just about Philadelphia tradition and down here at Coppin State, and Fang Mitchell coming out of Philadelphia and knowing kids that played at Roman Catholic and went to Maryland or went to Loyola down here. Philadelphia's just always been a basketball place.
Yes, it has. Yeah, and mentioning Jim Lynam, he had a play in my career when I was out of work. I was kind of down and out. And, you know, when you're out of work, the people who you normally call and they call you back, they don't call you back. That's a sign that you're not working anymore. So Lynam and I were classmates at St. Joe's. So he calls me and he says, Paul, just remember, if you're looking for a job, it only takes one person to love you. You only need one job. So that perked me up, and sure enough, he took the job at LMU, Loyola Marymount, where I then coached Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble, and he resigned to take a job with the Sixers with Matty Gukas. So he called me and he said, I think if you call LMU tomorrow, they might be interested. So I called, and Lynam helped me get that job.
Well, certainly famous for the Showtime Lakers as well as Loyola Marymount. You mentioned Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble, and you go back to me filling out March Madness brackets as a very young man. The book is The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. Coach Paul Westhead is here, and I have a million stories in the big city, but the tragedy with your time at Loyola Marymount and those incredible teams and scoring points and the book being called The System. All these years later, tell me the system. What's the system? And tell me about the book and getting people excited about picking up the book, because there is a legend to the system, isn't there?
Yeah, well, the system is very simple to describe. I put it in the first day of practice. We have five spots on the floor. The players have to run to those spots on every offensive possession, and they have to run as fast as they can each and every time. So if we have 100 possessions in a game, we're going to run the fast break 100 times and hopefully shoot within 4 seconds. And we're going to take the first open shot. It could be a slam dunk. It could be an open 25-foot jump shot. And there is the system. The question is, can you get your players to do it? The challenge of every fast break coach is, can he get his players to run fast enough of the times? And sometimes I did, like at LMU when we were averaging 122 points a game. And sometimes I didn't. And I got fired by the Denver Nuggets, for example. So there's no easy solution unless you can get the players to buy in and run as fast as they can.
Well, and there's so much that goes into that above and beyond just playing the game of basketball or the way normal coaches would teach the game, which is passing. So much is passing and eye, hand, and movement and knowing where people are going to go. Studying, as we brought up earlier, actually knowing the plays, right? And then there's just the chaotic way that it looked. You know, I mean, literally, coach, I'm from Baltimore, or as you would say, Baltimore. And you know, you guys played in the middle of the night on cable television 30 years ago, you know, and I'd be up in the middle of the night watching you guys take somebody's ass to halftime at 72 points. And I'm watching Duke and Maryland, you know, battle at 49-48 with 10 seconds left. And I'm just wondering whether there's two basketballs or what you're doing differently. And then you watch it, or you'd watch the highlights and Chris Berman reading it to you the morning after, or Olbermann, whoever it was, Dan Patrick back in those days. And the way you played the game, it just, most coaches wouldn't want to do that because they just wouldn't want that much passing, because much like the Ravens right now, just to bring it to what I do, most coaches in the NFL didn't want a quarterback playing games with the football knowing the ball's going to hit the ground two or three times, that the more you throw it around, the sloppier it can be.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it takes a special coach One of the coaches way back who gave me this system was Sonny Allen from Old Dominion University. And I spent a day with Sonny, and he gave me what he had. And he said, I have one last thing, coach. To do this, you have to be a little crazy. So I said, well, Sonny, I think I qualify for that. I can do that. But scoring, we had no problem with. In fact, you're talking about those low scores. One time we were playing out on the West Coast, and the score that went back east on the AP scores was that we won 99-92. And my friends from Philadelphia called me the next morning and said, coach, what happened? You only had 99 points. They were disappointed. And I said, well, you got the wrong score. That was the halftime score. The final was 182-152. When we got going, there was no stopping us.
Deep down, and I can see the salesman in you, Coach Paul Westhead, you had to think, well, how the hell am I not going to get kids here? Everyone's going to want to play here, right? Like, everyone wants to touch the ball and score and fill it up. That, you know, everyone gets a Michael Jordan stat line around here, right?
Yeah, I thought I was a pretty good recruiter, because I would go into the home and have the young man and his parents, and I'd say, so how would you like to average 28 points a game? And the young man would look at me and say, yeah. I said, you could do that in the first half in my system. And he'd like that. And then he'd finally say, well, you know, I like you, but I'm not so sure. And I'd say, okay, here's the final thing that you're going to get when you come to coach with me or play with me. You're going to average 30 points a game, and you never have to play defense. And he would say, coach, I'm coming. I'm in.
Well, the never having to play defense part, right? Like, that is – I think I've had many college basketball coaches come and sit in my home back in the day. I've been doing this 30 years, whether it's sitting with Dino Gaudio or sitting with Fang or sitting with any, you know, I've had Brian Rousham on, his coach all over the world. Right. No matter who you are, finding someone that actually plays defense, that leads with defense, that wants to play defense, that's a pretty rare kid in anywhere, any walk of life for the game of basketball, right? Like, that when you find that kid, you want to hug that kid, right?
Yeah, exactly. But deep down, even if they like playing defense, they want to score. They know that scoring is what gets attention. So if they're a high school player, scoring will get them a college scholarship. And if they go into the NBA, they know that going from 10 points a game to 15 points a game gets them a better contract. So everyone has this big contest. They say defense wins championships. I say offense wins championships.
Where's LeBron in all of this? I mean, you've watched it all. I mean, around Jordan, coaching against him, you know, obviously had these amazing players in Los Angeles for a period of your life as well. I mean, you've coached the greatest players ever. For what LeBron has done, for where the Lakers are, for where the league is, and Black Lives Matter, and incredible leaders out in front of this, starting in the commissioner's office, some thoughts about where the future of the sport is. Coach, I'm in a baseball city. We're in the last year of a lease. Obviously, nobody can go out in the middle of this plague and be a part of this. The NBA sort of beamed itself into the world in the middle of a plague, and, you know, LeBron is still doing it at a level that becomes unquestioned. And I've been a guy that's rooted against him, right? I mean, after the decision and leaving Cleveland and all that, I took all that hard 15 years ago, right?
Well, I think LeBron, as the years have moved forward, he's gotten better. 10 years ago, LeBron in key games would have the ball late in the game, go down the lane and pass. You know, and he would say, well, I was double teamed. Well, no kidding. You're the best player on the court. You think they would let you alone? But now, when he has the ball going down the lane late in the game, he's going to score. He's going to take it. He's going to take power and go to the basket and defy the defense. So LeBron has moved way up in the scale of, you know, the greatest. I'm still a Michael Jordan advocate. I think he is the best player ever, but LeBron is right there. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, Dr. J from the Sixers.
Oh, man. That's my guy. Now you're talking.
To say who the best was, but LeBron has certainly improved his position, and he's really helped basketball this year, especially in the bubble.
Who's the greatest coach ever? I mean, who's the coach maybe you learned the most from, and then give me a historical perspective on this?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I would say for sure my own coach, Jack Ramsey, fits that category. I mean, he taught me everything about the game. I defied him in many things. He would not, and he did not like my speed game of trying to shoot every 4 seconds. He thought there should be a little bit more control of the offense by the players and the coach. But Ramsey is classic coach. I had the good fortune to be with John Wooden at times out here in Los Angeles. He actually came over to LMU and spent a morning with me on his way out of town. I spent time at his home with his wife, Nell, when she was still living. And he was just so gracious. So Ramsey, John Wooden. And the guy who whipped me and I thought I was really smart was Dean Smith. You know, I thought I had him and he had a little bit more than I had. So
he coached defense, though. Coach, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on with us.
It's my pleasure. Always good to talk to a Ballmer man.
Oh, you know what? We'll get you some crab cakes. We'll get you back here. We'll make sure you don't eat any tourist crab cakes in our town, Coach,
okay.
All right?
And anytime you go to the races, bring me along. I'm a horse race fan.
Well, you know what? We've talked so much. I'm going to put the book back up here one more time. The speed game, my fast times at basketball with legendary head coach Paul Westhead. And you know, we didn't even talk about the ladies. We talked about that. We talked about the horses. But the horse racing industry, and you know, they have the Masters being played out of time right now. The Preakness came and went this year. We're very concerned. You know, the Preakness is a big, big part of Baltimore. Horse racing is a big part of our state and everything that we try to put back together here again. I'm a guy. I have a Preakness pin right here. I'll show it to you, Coach. Keep the Preakness in Baltimore. So we try to, you know.
I love it. Yeah.
You know, have you been to a Preakness in Baltimore before, Coach?
No, I have not. But when I was a young man, I used to go to Bowie Racetrack. I don't know if that's still alive and running.
It was an equestrian center. I actually bet the horses down at Bowie back in the late
80s. Yeah, I was there. Yep.
So, here's a name that would mean something to you. The great Charles Markwood Ekman. Charlie Ekman. Yes. You know, Charlie and I used to go down and bet the races in Bowie before he passed in the 90s. So, and you know, Charlie coached in the NBA and officiated in the NBA. So, he had a hell of a life. And I love basketball people. I don't get enough basketball people on, Coach. So, thanks for coming on with me. And I promise you, when I'm at the Palestra, I will think of you. I promise you.
Thanks, Nestor.
There he goes. Coach Paul Westhead, the book is out, The Fast Times and the System. You can find that at anywhere books are sold. Makes a perfect holiday gift and a great Philadelphia guy. Anytime I get a Philadelphia accent and a Baltimore accent in one room, you know we're going to make spaghetti out of the English language. Ness at Baltimore Positive finds me. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore, we never stop talking. Baltimore Positive and a little bit of basketball.